From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
For the first time since the 1960s and early 70s, more than 100,000 American troops are fighting abroad, and once again, at home, Americans are concerned about their civil liberties.
Today, we'll look at the candidacy of Wesley Clark, the first four-star general to run for president as a Democrat.
General Wesley Clark has a reputation as an anti-war candidate, despite any definitive statements in opposition to the Iraq War, and in spite of having cheered the great victory just after the fall of Baghdad.
John Ashcroft decides to disclose information about what libraries FBI agents have gone to. He also denounces librarians as hysterical who denounce the Patriot Act.
The Patriot Act attacks the civil liberties and the privacy and confidentiality of library users.
We'll also look at the so-called terror list. The administration has created a master list of 100,000 names that it will now distribute to government agencies and businesses. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Guardian of London is reporting that Saudi Arabia is considering acquiring nuclear weapons to counter the possible nuclear threat from Israel and Iran. Meanwhile, Arab countries yesterday urged the UN nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, to force Israel to let inspectors assess its nuclear program as it is doing with Iran. President Bush's $87 billion request for Iraq is coming under intense criticism from some Democratic legislators on Capitol Hill. Congressmember David Obie of Wisconsin issued the report showing how Bush is spending more money per person in Iraq than in the United States in areas such as hospitals and sewage improvements. Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware introduced legislation that would reduce the size of the Bush tax cut to the wealthiest 1% of residents in order to pay for the $87 billion tab. Economic news out of Washington continues to worsen. The Treasury Department reported that for the first time in history, the federal deficit had blown through the $400 billion mark. And the White House estimates the deficit could reach $535 billion in the next fiscal year. Just days after Vice President Dick Cheney suggested links between Iraq and 9/11 existed, President Bush said yesterday there's no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved in the attacks. Cheney said on NBC's Meet the Press that success in Iraq means, quote, we will have struck a major blow right at the heart of the base, if you will, the geographic base of the terrorists who had us under assault now for many years, but most especially on 9/11. In other Iraq news, the former UN chief weapons inspector, Hans Blix, says he believes Iraq destroyed most of its weapons of mass destruction 10 years ago. Blix said Hussein may have simply wanted to give the impression he had banned weapons to deter a military attack. Blix also accused the British government of using spin in developing its pre-war intelligence. Agence France-Presse is reporting that U.S. soldiers shot dead a teenager and wounded four others when troops opened fire at a wedding celebration in Fallujah. The shooting came on the same day that a tape emerged purportedly from Saddam Hussein that called on Iraqis to fight the occupation and for the U.S. to leave Iraq. Meanwhile, the U.S. is stepping up plans to create a 40,000-strong new Iraqi army to relieve some of the pressure on U.S. troops. This news from Wall Street. The chair and chief executive of the New York Stock Exchange, Richard Grasso, was forced to resign yesterday over protests that his $140 million retirement package was excessive. Meanwhile, Merrill Lynch yesterday accepted responsibility for the alleged criminal activity of some of its employees who dealt with Enron. in order to avoid prosecution. The financial giant agreed to let the government monitor portions of its business and to avoid financial arrangements like it had with Enron. Also yesterday, three former Merrill Lynch bankers pleaded not guilty to charges they conspired to help client Enron record a phony profit. Washington, D.C. is largely shut down as Hurricane Isabel heads to the region. Over 300,000 people in North Carolina and Virginia have been told to evacuate their homes. And former member of the Weather Underground, Kathy Boudin, was released yesterday after 22 years in prison. She was jailed in connection with an armed car robbery carried out by the Black Liberation Army that left three people dead. In prison, she helped create programs for women who are infected with HIV. And Spanish Judge Baltazar Garzon has formally charged 35 men, including al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and veteran Al Jazeera correspondent Tahir Al-Luni, with involvement in the September 11th attacks. Al Jazeera says its reporter is innocent and has accused the United States and Israel of inciting Spain to incriminate him. Al-Luni interviewed bin Laden shortly after September 11th. The Syrian-born reporter was arrested on September 5th and was ordered to remain in prison without bail pending trial. The judge emphasized Al-Luni did not participate in terrorist actions, but he accused him of using his journalistic work to move money and assist an individual to obtain a residency permit. Spanish Judge Baltazar Garzon came to international attention several years ago for his attempt to extradite and try former Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
Well, it's good to see that you've blown in, Juan. The hurricane is making its way. And interesting also that the people, as they struggle to prepare in South Carolina and North Carolina, they don't have quite the National Guard or equipment backup that they're used to, because many of them and the equipment are in Iraq.
Yes, but FEMA claims to be on the case. We'll see if they're on the case as much as they were here in New York after the World Trade Center attacks.
Well, today we're going to be taking a look at the USA Patriot Act. We're going to be talking about John Ashcroft's comments that people who criticize USA Patriot Act are hysterical. We'll be speaking with the former head of the American Library Association. And we're also going to be looking at the candidacy of General Wesley Clark. But first, we're going to go to Robert Fisk. Robert Fisk in Iraq. We're trying to get him on the phone now. We just had him. We lost him. We can have some trouble on these satellite phones. So I believe instead we're going to start with General Wesley Clark and his candidacy. We're going to begin by listening to an excerpt of the speech of General Wesley Clark that he gave yesterday in Arkansas. General Wesley Clark is the first four-star general to run for president as a Democrat. This is General Wesley Clark.
Now I warn you, we'll ask the tough questions as we move forward, and we'll hold this administration accountable. Yeah. Why is America lost 2.7 million jobs? Why has America lost the prospect of a $5 trillion surplus and turned it into a $5 trillion deficit that deepens every day? Why has our country lost our sense of security and feels the shadow of fear? Why has America lost the respect of so many people around the world? That's the questions we're going to be asking. And one more. Why? Why are so many here in America hesitant to speak out and ask questions?
General Wesley Clark announcing yesterday in Arkansas, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and the man who led the 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999. He announced his candidacy yesterday, bringing to 10 the number of Democratic contenders hoping to unseat President Bush in next year's election. Again, Clark, the first four-star general in history to run for president as a Democrat. The question is he an anti-war warrior, as he has been billed? We are going to talk to Robert Fisk in Baghdad about this. Also, member of the founder of the Draft Wesley Clark for President Committee, and Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. We're going to begin with Steve Rendell in the studio. I was surprised to hear, not that Wesley Clark was running, Steve, but that he is being cast as anti-war. Because in the lead-up to war, in the lead-up to the invasion and during, I listened to Wesley Clark every day, watched him on CNN, and I did not get that feeling.
Well, Amy, I had to study the transcripts. Some of the listeners may know that we did a study of the first 3 weeks of the war, and we looked at six nightly newscasts, including CNN. And as you know, Wesley Clark was a hired analyst on CNN. And when we started hearing him in this sort of furious speculation about whether or not he was going to run, especially in the last few weeks, we kept hearing him cast as an anti-war candidate. Well, I hadn't seen much of that. If I could give you a couple of sites here, the Boston Globe described him as a former NATO commander who also happens to have opposed the war. Michael Wolff, writing in New York Magazine, said, "Face it, the only anti-war candidate America is ever going to elect is one who is a four-star general," which I guess means that the only legitimate anti-war person is a four-star general. Newsweek's Howard Fineman said, Clark, quote, "is as anti-war as Dean." The Washington Post described Clark and Dean, quote, "both oppose the war in Iraq and both are generating excitement on the internet with grassroots activists." Well, now, a couple of months ago, still well after the war, in an interview with Paula Zahn on CNN, Clark, some people might have mistaken Clark for an anti as having opposed the war, when he said, "From the beginning, I have had my doubts about this mission, Paula, and I have shared them previously on CNN." But a review of his statements during, before, and after shows that he never made any definitive statement against the war at any time. What criticisms he had were criticisms of the logistics, the tactics, criticisms meant to increase the effectiveness of the fighting force there. What we were able to find, I think.
What about the claims that he was at least espousing that the United States not act without United Nations approval?
Well, this was another sort of tactical thing. If we can get all our ducks in a row, then fine. The war is fine.
Well, let's turn to John Lenko, who is the co-founder of the DraftWesleyClark.com campaign. Can you talk about... John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry. Can you talk about Wesley Clark for president?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I could tell you what we saw from the draft movement's perspective. I mean, we saw someone that we felt could be a not only a president in wartime, but a president in peace. I think what we saw in General Clark was someone who looked at making our nation a safer place and didn't equate it with the number of bombs we dropped, but equated it with steps designed to make our nation a safer place. I mean, it seems logical, but unfortunately, I don't think it's something that we have in the current administration.
What about this portrayal of him in the last few weeks as an anti-war alternative to President Bush?
Well, I think a lot of what we saw, and I could just speak from the draft movement's perspective, is we saw someone who seemed to have a more sensible approach to Iraq. I know he described the operation as quote elective surgery. In other words, this was something that, yeah, perhaps there were reasons, but when you had Al-Qaeda still out there and you had Osama bin Laden, certainly there were more pressing priorities. So, I can't speak specifically for the general. I can just tell you what we saw from the draft movement's perspective, but it certainly seemed to be a much more enlightened and sensible approach than what we were seeing in the current administration.
Your response to that,
Steve? I'm here as sort of like correcting the record guy. I'm not here to debate with somebody from Wesley Clark's campaign, but to point out at a time back in January when millions of people, leading up to one of the biggest demonstrations worldwide that's ever happened, Clark said on CNN, quote, "I probably wouldn't have made the moves that got us to this point, but just assuming that we're here at this point, then I think that the president is going to have to move ahead despite the fact that the allies have reservations." A little later, this was in early February. Remember the huge demonstrations around the world, and I believe that was on February 12th. Clark said on CNN, "The credibility of the United States is on the line, and Saddam Hussein has the weapons, and so, we're going to go ahead and do this, and the rest of the world has got to get with us. The UN has got to come in and belly up to the bar on this." These are hardly the words when millions of people just a week later would be in the streets demonstrating against the war. These are hardly the words of an anti-war candidate.
John Klenko.
Well, I mean, it doesn't seem inconsistent at all to me. I mean, well, I think what the general was saying, and again, I could just speak from the draft movement's perspective, but I mean, a lot of what we saw was, it was a pretty reasoned approach. The idea that, this is not something that made sense to do, but, once you're there, once you're on the verge of battle or engaged in battle, then it becomes a different matter. Once you have no choice and the president has already moved ahead, then at a certain point, the question doesn't become, well, are we going to be engaged or not? But, well, we already are engaged, and what do you do at that point to minimize the damage?
Zoltan Grossman is on the phone as well. He's professor of geography at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. You followed extensively the bombing of Yugoslavia. Your response to the announcement of the 10th Democrat to enter the presidential race, General Wesley Clark, the supreme Allied commander ahead of NATO during that bombing?
Well, I think General Clark has rightly criticized President Bush for being unprepared for the post-war, for the aftermath of the Iraq invasion. But if you look at his record in the 1999 war against Yugoslavia, you see four different aspects of the general being completely unprepared for the events that spiraled out of control once NATO bombs started dropping on Serbia. There's actually four different aspects to this. One is there was a civil war prior to the NATO bombing in which about 2,000 civilians died. The CIA had actually warned General Clark that a stick in the nest, NATO bombing, could provoke even worse ethnic cleansing by the government of Slobodan Milosevic, and that's exactly what happened. Massive ethnic cleansing that took place after the bombing started, not before the bombing started. And afterwards, General Clark had to admit that this was entirely predictable, but defended the war as coercive diplomacy. Second aspect was alienation of Serbian civilians who hated Slobodan Milosevic, much like there are many Iraqis who opposed both Saddam and U.S. occupation. Many Serbs in cities that voted against Milosevic were bombed, and not just bombed by NATO, but with cluster bombs, with depleted uranium munitions. Civilian infrastructure, trains, buses, TV stations, hospitals, power plants, water plants were all hit. The third aspect is what happened after the NATO troops entered Kosovo, after the Russians pressured Milosevic to withdraw from Kosovo. there immediately started a reverse ethnic cleansing by the Kosovo Liberation Army, the Albanian ethnic militia, against any non-Albanians, Serbs, Roma or Gypsies, Jews who were expelled from Kosovo, who were many of them killed, not to the same numerical level as what had happened to them. But I think in the end, Kosovo was actually more ethnically pure. And this is the goal of all of these ethnic militias in Bosnia or Kosovo, is the purity of their territory.
Zoltan Grossman speaking to us from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, university there. John Hlinko, I'll just get your response of the Draft WesleyClark.com campaign.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I could just tell you what we saw from our perspective. And, you know, war is a terrible thing. There's no two ways about it. But, you know, I guess when we looked at what had happened in Kosovo, and we looked at what was going on now in the two wars under the Bush administration, I mean, Slobodan Milosevic right now is on trial. The ethnic cleansing has, you know, for all practical purposes, ceased, at least, you know, as much as is possible. You know, and you contrast that with what's happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, and, you know, is any policy perfect? No, of course not. But when you say, you know, which one had certainly a better outcome, and who would you trust more, you know, if such a war is forced upon us in the future, you know, we look at General Clark, and the choice was clear as to who the more capable commander-in-chief would be.
Well, John Hlinko, we have just reached Robert Fisk in Baghdad. We want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of the Draft WesleyClark.com campaign. Zoltan Grossman, thanks for being with us from the University of Wisconsin. We're going not to the break right now, which we usually do, but because we have Robert Fisk on his satellite phone at this moment, we want to go directly to him. Robert Fisk, we'll get your comment at the beginning, hearing that Wesley Clark is now running for president as the anti-war warrior, and then we'd like to get your observations of what's happening right now on the ground in Iraq.
Well, I have to say, first of all, about General Clark, that I was on the ground in Serbia and Kosovo when he ran the war there, and he didn't seem to be very anti-war at the time. I had as one of my tasks to go out over and over again to look at the civilian casualties of that war. At one point, NATO bombed a hospital in which Yugoslav soldiers, against the rules of law, were hiding, along with the patients, and almost all the patients were killed. This was the war, remember, where the first attack was made on a radio station, the television, Serb radio and television building. Since then, we've had attacks twice on the Al Jazeera television stations. First of all, in Afghanistan in 2001, and then killing their chief correspondent again in Baghdad this year. This was a general who, I remember, bombed a series of bridges, in one of which an aircraft bombed a train, and after he'd seen the train and had come to a stop, the pilot bombed the bridge again. I saw one occasion when a plane came in, bombed a bridge over a river in Serbia proper, as we like to call it, and after about 12 minutes, when rescuers had arrived, the bridge too narrow even for tanks, bombed the rescuers. I remember General Clark telling us that more than 100 Yugoslav tanks had been destroyed in the weeks of that war. And when the war came to an end, we discovered the number of Yugoslav tanks destroyed were 11, 100 indeed. So this is not a man, frankly, whom if I was an American, I'd vote for. But not being American, I don't have to.
Robert Fisk speaking to us in Iraq. And then you have the time that the British general, Michael Jackson, Wesley Clark had told him to get his British troops to the airport before the Russians got there so it wouldn't be perceived that the Russians were liberating. And General Michael Jackson responded to him, "I'm not going to start World War III."
Yes, Jackson did indeed say that, and one member of Jackson's staff has confirmed to me that the quote is true. I think one or two of the words, are probably the verb is wrong, but yeah, World War III was correct. There was a very strange atmosphere to that war, and over and over again, when NATO had bombed a target that was clearly illegitimate, or when they killed large numbers of civilians, they were either silent or they lied. We had the very famous occasion, or infamous occasion, when American troops, or rather, I'm sorry, American aircraft, bombed an Albanian refugee convoy in Kosovo and claimed later, or NATO claimed later, it was probably Serb aircraft. And it was only when we got there and found the NATO markings on the bombs that NATO fessed up and admitted they'd done it themselves and had been confused. When I went to the scene months later and tracked down the survivors, it turned out that although they were confused, NATO aircraft had gone on bombing that convoy for 35 minutes, even though there were civilians there, because mixed in among them, most cruelly, this was an act of Milosevic's regime, were military vehicles as well. We shouldn't be romantic about the Serb military or the Serb security police. They were killers and murderers. But NATO, in its war against the Serbs, committed a number of acts which I think got very, very close to being war crimes, and General Clark was the commander. So this is a man who wants to be the president, Democratic president of the United States of America. Well, I don't interest myself very much in what he thinks about the last war in Iraq. I watched it at first hand and have my own opinions. But I sure as hell know what it was like to be under the bombs of his war in Serbia. And
well, Robert Fisk,
Robert
Fisk, this is Juan Gonzalez here with Amy. In speaking about civilian casualties, you've been doing several articles now on the story that is not being covered at all, especially here in the United States, which is the civilian toll, the lives being lost every day in Iraq as a result of the U.S. occupation. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I started doing this story here because I'm doing a series of articles because I was very struck by an article that appeared in the New York Times last week that talked about the terrible toll of casualties over the summer months. And it was paragraph 3 before I realized that the terrible toll applied only to 70 or 72 American soldiers in this country. And thousands of Iraqi civilians are dying by gunfire and other forms of violence in this country since April 9, because of the anarchy and chaos let loose after the, quote, liberation, unquote, of Baghdad. Again, we don't need to be romantic about Saddam. It was his government that committed the crimes before the war. It's now Iraqis who are committing the crimes after the war. But the real problem is that there is no security, and what is happening is an absolute slaughter every night of Iraqi people, either murdered in revenge killings by thieves, gunned down at American checkpoints by trigger-happy U.S. soldiers, involved in family feuds. I've just come, literally, as I speak to you now, from a mortuary in Baghdad. They've just taken in 21 gunshot victims, dead. I spoke to 5 of the bereaved family, all shot down with people trying to steal their cars, or killed by thieves in the night, or killed in killings which were by persons unknown. Weaponry is flourishing here. You hear the shooting every night. The whole of Baghdad skitters with gunfire. I went to one hospital, the Al-Mulk Hospital, where the mortuary attendant told me that almost 40% of the total dead that come in at that mortuary are killed at U.S. checkpoints by soldiers, either because the cars approach too quickly to the checkpoint or because American troops come under fire and fire back at the civilians in the area without making direct contact with whoever is their aggressor. On one occasion recently, for example, 4 days ago, a woman and her child were brought dead to the Al-Mulk Hospital after they were killed by U.S. forces who opened fire at people who were shooting in the air at a wedding party. Over and over again this happens. We've had a case about 6 weeks ago, which I personally investigated, in which 2 men got too close, drove up to a U.S. checkpoint. It wasn't a usual checkpoint. It was just a piece of barbed wire thrown across the road at a very poor suburb of Baghdad called Hayal Galani. The Americans opened fire at the car. When the car was burned out, I counted around 23 bullet holes in it, but the bullets caught fire to the petrol, and I don't know if they were still alive or not, but the 2 passengers, both males, were burned alive. They were burned to death anyway. I assume some of them may have, one of them may have, or 2 may have survived as the car was burning. As the car was on fire, according to those who saw it happen, the Americans packed up and abandoned their checkpoint. I went to the mortuary again at the Al-Mulk Hospital afterwards and found these 2 skeletons with burned flesh on, their identity papers long ago consumed by the fire, and the car itself, the registration plate, had melted into the road. So again, 2 Iraqi families were waiting that night for loved ones who would never come home.
In one of your articles, Robert, you estimate that as many as perhaps 1,000 Iraqis a week are dying across the country. And that, but that also you're having trouble getting to the hospitals. The occupation authorities are not allowing journalists or making it difficult for journalists to get to hospitals or mortuaries.
Absolutely. The Coalition Provisional Authority, the occupation authorities call themselves that, have told through the Ministry of Health, the new Ministry of Health under the CPA here, who, of course, work to the occupation authorities, that journalists are not allowed to go to hospitals unless they have official permission from the new ministers, who, of course, work for the occupation authorities. This means we're not, in theory, supposed to find out the figures. In fact, we can get into the hospitals because we know many of the doctors. There are other ways in. And usually the security guards are very sympathetic towards us. They're Iraqi. And they want us to tell the story of this great tragedy for the Iraqis. I'll just give you, for example, the Baghdad City Morgue, which I've just spent 6 hours in. Yesterday, they had 21 dead, of whom 12 were killed by gunfire. This morning, they had another 5 by 10 a.m. Baghdad time. Now, if you add that up and you turn it into a month of killings, and you remember that there's 20 dead a day of gunfire being brought even to the Najaf Cemetery, which is about 200 miles south of Baghdad, who are killed by violence. Not just, of course, by the Americans, killed by family revenge, killings, shootings by thieves, people trying to stop looters who get killed by accident, caught in crossfire. You're talking of at least 1,000 Iraqis dying every week. But, of course, it's impossible, not just because of the restrictions placed on journalists going to the hospitals, but it's impossible to go to every hospital in every city of Iraq every morning and put together the death toll. But it is extraordinary. And, you know, I had one case this morning, a young man, only son of a Shiite from the very poorest area of Baghdad, had been killed at his door, no one knew why. 4 very, very angry Shiites arrived with his body at the mortuary, one of them in militia uniforms, I think he was a member of the so-called Badr Brigade, and one of them was shouting and said, this is because there is no security. America doesn't want us to have security. It wants to divide our society. We won't allow it. We will explode ourselves against the Americans, he said. He was talking about suicide bombers. This is a Shiite, not a Sunni from the so-called Sunni Triangle. So what is happening is that there's a growing feeling among Iraqis, at least those who are politically inclined, that the Americans do not want to stop the insecurity. Among those Iraqis who don't take such a conspiratorial view, there is a milder, but in my view, quite devastating view or attitude that the Americans don't really care very much about the Iraqis. They like to talk about bringing them democracy, liberating them, but they care only about Western soldiers who killed. They don't really care about the lives of ordinary Iraqis. And over again, we've had examples of people shot by the Americans at the checkpoints, and the Americans have not even bothered to find out who they shot down, who they killed, who they wounded. They are not on the streets at night. We had one very sad case the other day of a man whose family I spoke to who did survive. He was a night watchman at a building. His factory was attacked by looters. He fired back at the looters, and the Americans turned up and shot him in the chest. He's now just undergone, 2 days ago, his second operation to save his life. But he hasn't once been visited by American forces. No one said sorry. No one says, would you like some compensation? We can help you. In some cases, we do know, especially in outlying and very tough areas. The Americans and other Western forces have offered and given money of compensation to families of those they've killed. And I think the Americans were doing that to the policemen, at least 8 of whom were killed by a U.S., I think the 3rd Infantry Division did it near Fallujah on Thursday of last week. But outrageously, for a long time, the Americans just said they had no information about the killings, long after we'd gone there and established that it was all U.S. ammunition from an infantry unit that was used to kill the policeman. At one point, I found a policeman's teeth and brains beside the road. Had they been American brains and teeth, I don't think they would have been left there. It's this overall feeling, not so much, and I don't go along with conspiracy theories, that the U.S. want a civil war, want to divide people, want violence. No, because they're also becoming victims of it, though on an infinitesimally smaller scale than the Iraqis. But that the Americans don't really care about Iraqis. And that is the cancer that is eating into this society now.
Robert Fisk, I want to ask you about General Powell's visit, Secretary of State General Powell's visit to Baghdad. We still have Steve Rendell in the studio, who's leaving in 1 minute, as we listen to this description of what's happening in Iraq. We were wrapping up the discussion of Wesley Clark, whether or not he was for this war. Your final comments, Steve.
Well, I'd like to just say that politicians would like to be all things to all people. And our problem is not with Wesley Clark or his campaign. It's with the media's portrayal of him. Now, one point that I'd like to say, your listeners should really go and look at the daily column that Clark wrote for the Times of London right around the time of the fall of Baghdad. He wrote there, for instance, the day after the fall of Baghdad, he wrote, quote, "Liberation is at hand. Liberation, the powerful bomb that justifies painful sacrifices, erases lingering doubts and reinforces bold actions." He also wrote that George W. Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair, quote, "should be proud of their resolve in the face of so much doubt." This is the day after, this is on April 10th, the day after the so-called fall of Baghdad. He was cheering this event, and it's very hard for us to see reporters, you know, casting him as an anti-war candidate.
Steve Rendell, of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Robert Fisk, nothing succeeds like success. It sounds like people who didn't know how it was going to turn out wanted to make sure they were on the side of the winning forces, which makes me think of a piece you wrote where you said that Thomas Friedman was in Iraq. He asked a U.S. soldier, he was looking for something, for directions, and they said to him, "That's on the enemy side of the bridge."
Yeah, I mean, you have to be reality-wise, Amy. Here in Baghdad, American troops are attacked up to, I'm told, 60 times a day, just in Baghdad alone. And they're losing on average a man a day. So if you're an American soldier, you're 20 years old, you didn't think it would work out like this, you were conned into believing the war was a great thing for democracy and liberation, and you're being shot at every day, you regard every Iraqi as a potential enemy. So, of course, the guy said, "Enemy side of the bridge." It's a very telltale remark because it shows how terribly wrong everything has gone for the military, for the U.S. administration, for our own dear Prime Minister Tony Blair. But individually, you find American soldiers here whom you can be very sympathetic with and who realize it's gone wrong. You know, I talked to U.S. troops in the streets of Baghdad, and they do not want to vote for the Republican Party if they ever did before at the next election in the United States. You also find soldiers who are behaving very badly with lack of fire discipline, lack of discipline in every kind. I mean, I was down in Fallujah a few weeks ago when an American soldier saw a man sitting in a chair in the street and said, "You get up and I'll break your fucking neck." Well, that is not the kind of language that's going to win hearts and minds. When I complained to his sergeant of the way it's spoken, he made excuses and said, "Well, the guy got up at 3 o'clock this morning. He's been shot at every day. He's been here since March or whatever." So I said, "Well, you know, I understand all that. And one has to have sympathy as a human being for another human being who's in a predicament. But it was your country that wanted to invade this place. You were desperate to come in. You didn't want the arms inspectors to finish. You haven't found any weapons of mass destruction. Now you're here, and you don't like it." And this is a big problem. Over and over again, I'm finding soldiers who say, yes, you know, we believe we can help the Iraqi people. They take the line, mostly officers. But you find many, many officers below that who say, "I want to go home." And this is an army that's tired, that's in low morale, low fire discipline, low discipline all around. The number of shootings of civilians is skyrocketing. You know, I've just been talking to you about the dead. If you go into the hospitals here in the afternoon,
Robert, I want to ask you about
wounded coming in.
Robert, I'd like to ask you about this issue of low morale. Those of us who remember the Vietnam War understand that a major turning point was when those soldiers there realized that they were not engaged in a war of liberation. They gradually began to build up resistance and enormous morale problems with soldiers going AWOL and shooting their own officers at times. Are you seeing any signs that this demoralization among the troops may possibly even lead to resistance within the ranks of the soldiers?
Well, I'd say war there to you. We haven't reached the Vietnam stage yet. No one's fragging their own officers. There was an incident, wasn't there, in Kuwait, where I think a grenade was thrown by a U.S. soldier at other U.S. soldiers. No, look, we haven't reached the Vietnam point, and after all, America was losing thousands of troops in Vietnam, and it's only in the hundreds in Iraq since the war began. And as I say, when I talk to ordinary soldiers, there's a great difference, for example, between units that were here during the war and haven't left, that actually fought in the war, lost quite a few people, for them anyway, and are still here and feel that they've been lied to because they were supposed to have gone home after this victorious, wonderful war in which they were liberating people. And the newly arrived troops, like, for example, the 101st Airborne up in Mosul, whose morale seems to be a lot higher, although, frankly, their attitude towards house raids, breaking down doors and screaming at people, doesn't seem to be much better than, say, the 3rd Infantry Division, who clearly don't have the same morale problems. But we're not at the Vietnam stage, and we shouldn't pretend that we are. What we should compare it to is Lebanon in 1982, when it was 6 months before anyone threw a stone at an American soldier. And now, within 6 months, they've killed scores of American soldiers here in Iraq. And what has happened is that there is a real guerrilla army at work, increasingly sophisticated. I was very interested to note when I met the U.S. general who was in charge of prisoners of war at the former and horrific Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad 3 days ago, she actually referred to a resistance force. She didn't talk about terrorists, not once did it cross her lips. And what you find is that the real soldiers, I'm talking about non-reservists, full-time U.S. soldiers, they know they're involved in a guerrilla war. They know it's not working. They know the place is falling to bits. The problem, they tell me, is that when it gets up to the generals on your side of the lake, they don't want to admit it. I have a colleague of mine on the State Department press corps, which arrived with Colin Powell, whom I was present at Powell's very strange press conference here. And my colleague told me that they still don't realize in Washington how bad it is. And that's the impression one gets on the ground here.
Why was it strange? We only have 30 seconds. Your phone probably has less. But also, I just wanted to get to Fallujah, to the U.S. soldiers who apparently came a day before, who killed something like eight Iraqi policemen and a Jordanian guard this month.
Yeah, well, I went down there. What obviously happened is the policemen, once they were under fire, screamed, "We are the police, we are the police." The shooting went on. They then fled into the Jordanian army hospital compound, and the Americans then opened fire at the compound for up to 30 minutes, setting several of the buildings on fire. This is a hospital run by America's Jordanian allies. These were soldiers without fire discipline. You tell me for the first time, I haven't even learned this here, that they've just arrived in Iraq. Well, they clearly have a lot to learn, don't they?
The report is American soldiers just arrived in Fallujah the day before. But finally, the Powell press conference.
I'm sorry, I mean, the line broke there. Would you?
Oh, just finally, the Powell press conference.
Well, the extraordinary thing was that, you know, Powell presented everything as upbeat. He suggested that journalists were concentrating on negative things. He wasn't trying, he said, to persuade us how we should tell our stories or what our agenda should be, but we should concentrate on all the goodwill towards the occupation forces or the CPA, the coalition. Ambassador Bremer, the proconsul here, American proconsul, stepped forward to say there was more than 1,600,000 barrels of oil produced the previous day. It doesn't change the fact that Iraq is still importing oil, even though it's one of the richest oil countries in the world. But you simply couldn't get Powell in any question to talk about the fact that so many things are going wrong. And you wondered, had he brought the fantasy from Washington, or was he being fed the fantasy here in Baghdad by Bremer and his staff at the CPA? The fact is that months after the war was officially supposed to be over, there are hundreds of people dying in this country every week by violence. I'm just watching two Apache helicopters, as I speak to you now, flying just over the buildings in front of me on anti-terrorist patrol, quote-unquote, as it's called. There is a real guerrilla war underway here, and when you're on the ground, you realize that is moving out of control. And Washington is still trying to present this as a success story, and it's not, any more than Afghanistan.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Robert Fisk, for being with us. Robert Fisk is a correspondent for the Independent newspaper based in Beirut right now in Iraq, returning as he has so many times. Thank you for joining us. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we return, we're going to talk about the attack John Ashcroft, the attorney general, made on the country's largest library association. And then we're going to talk about the master terror list that the administration has developed of 100,000 so-called terror suspects that was being sent out to businesses and government agencies. Stay with us.
I don't want to be late. I don't want to be late. The time is at hand. We must seek to repatriate. I don't want to be late. I don't want to be late. The time is at hand. We must seek that promised land. Moses saw the land.
Yes, he saw the land.
Music by Prince Ala here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And in this item from the Common Dreams News Center today, we read Attorney General John Ashcroft has accused the country's biggest library association and other critics of fueling what he calls, quote, baseless hysteria about the government's ability to pry into the public's reading habits. In an unusually pointed attack in a speech Ashcroft gave, he condemned the American Library Association and other Justice Department critics for believing that the FBI wants to, quote, know how far you have gotten on the latest Tom Clancy novel.
Well, we're joined right now by the former head of the American Library Association, Mitch Friedman. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. Good to see you again.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you talk about this battle that's going on between your association, the largest library association in the country, and the Attorney General of the United States?
It's the largest library association in the world and 65,000 members. So it's a funny battle in that after he made all these baseless accusations and set up all these straw men that he knocked down, he called the president of the American Library Association yesterday to say he was going to release all this information about that had been confidential about the number of requests made of libraries and businesses. We've been seeking this information since the inception of the Patriot Act.
What is it that he's going to let you know?
Well, it's not exactly clear. The exact quote is something to the effect of he's going to make public the classified confidential report that the Justice Department created or wrote pertaining to Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. That's the part that has to do with their ability to use secret courts to get at library records and other business records.
And what's been the main thrust of why the association has been so upset about this provision?
Well, the thing is we have there's two fundamental constitutional amendments, the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. Libraries of the United States have been deeply committed to the privacy and confidentiality of library users. We don't give up information about our patrons. We don't ask them their names if they want to ask us a reference question. We've tried to protect them over the decades since we've been in business. The one basis law enforcement officials have had for getting library records is they go to a judge, and with the reference to the Fourth Amendment, they have to show probable cause. There's no search and seizure without probable cause for making that acquisition. The Patriot Act took away probable cause. The FBI goes to a secret court and says this has relevance to an ongoing terrorist investigation. That's the criterion. So we've got to turn over records. What's more, it's a felony if I tell you about it. If a library director says we've had a request from the U.S. Justice Department for our library citizens' records, they have to keep quiet about it. They can't tell anybody. They can't tell the person whose records are being searched, which is a total change from the state laws that provided protections for people.
You have a program, libraries, librarians, that if you get your book back on time, basically yes. it erases any mention of name or information of the person who took it out?
Right. When these computer systems were created, we had specifications in those programs that said you have to break the link between the user and the books they took out. Once they're returned, they don't have fines or settle all the rest of it. We don't want to keep records about what people read. It's not our business.
Has any librarian stepped forward to challenge the law? And
no librarians have stepped forward, Juan, because it's a felony. People talk about a gag order.
The question of it, the constitutionality of it.
But that's the point, though. If they challenge the constitutionality of it, they have to say that they've had this unconstitutional request made of them. And as soon as they open their mouth about that, they have committed a felony. And people use the word gag order, but gag order isn't as strong as felony, which is what's actually written into the Patriot Act.
Well, the Washington Post is saying today the Justice Department, which has repeatedly been accused of encroaching on civil liberties in its war on terrorism, has never actually used a controversial provision of the USA Patriot Act that allows it to seek records from libraries, bookstores, or other businesses, according to a confidential memo from Attorney General John Ashcroft. Ashcroft said in the memo to FBI Director Robert Mueller that he decided to declassify the previously secret information because of his concern that the public not be misled about the manner in which the U.S. Department of Justice and the FBI in particular have been utilizing the authorities provided in the USA Patriot Act. The number of times the provision has been used to date is zero, Ashcroft said in the memo, which was obtained by the Washington Post. What do you say about that?
Well, what do I say about it?
I have
no idea whether it's fiction or fact, but what I do know is a library director who has to remain nameless, because if I disclose that information, I'll be creating a felony situation for the library director who told me. He said that he had gotten at least three requests for information about patron records. So I don't know how consistent that is with what Mr. Ashcroft said, but the kind of other statements Mr. Ashcroft has made about librarians and what we're complaining about gives me pause as to the accuracy, validity, and truth of these claims.
Did the library director comply?
The library director, so far as I know, negotiated, yes, in a word, yes. So far as I was given to understand by that director.
I also know of a situation, these are very difficult situations because, as you said, if it is known that a person who's been approached by the FBI reveals that information to anyone except to another person who they need to get the information from.
And they can tell a lawyer also.
That they could be charged with a felony.
Exactly, exactly.
But in a situation where the authorities came in and downloaded computer files from a public archive.
Yeah. Well, the public libraries around the country, many of them have taken steps to try and eliminate or destroy information that might be sought later on. They keep records. No library has enough terminals for the people that want to use the internet, so there's sign-up sheets. But at the end of the day, they get rid of the sign-up sheets. Some libraries don't even take names. They give a number to it, and they call the number, so they don't even know who's using the terminal. But it's a history of privacy and confidentiality and our professional concerns for library users. And the state laws on the books were perfectly adequate for getting information about library users. They had to go to a judge or a grand jury, but the test was probable cause, as stipulated in the Fourth Amendment. And they're not doing that with the Patriot Act.
I don't know if kids usually think of their local librarians as freedom fighters, but you have a new role now. I've always said that you could have a new campaign out, an ad campaign that says, get your library book back on time or else, with that program that will delete the name if you get it back on time. Well, Mitch Friedman, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Are there any words of wisdom to library patrons? You've actually put up warnings that I think have very much angered the Justice Department at libraries around the country.
There's been some libraries that have put up warnings. Others haven't.
What do they say?
Well, they say, we may give up your information about you and we can't tell you, and the FBI can come in and take information about you anytime they feel like it.
So, watch out.
A last word of I'd like to just put a plug in my little pin here, better salaries for library workers. This is just one more thing that librarians are doing to protect their users and part of their complex roles of being a librarian. They should be paid better. Thanks, Amy.
Mitch Friedman, former head of the American Library Association. As we move to our last segment today, Bush administration announcing the creation of a massive computerized watch list that'll contain over 100,000 names of individuals the government claims are, quote, known and suspected terrorists. The watch list will be widely accessible to law enforcement agents, border police, airport workers, as well as some private industries. It'll contain the name of both international and domestic so-called suspects.
Attorney General John Ashcroft has praised the new terrorist screening center because it will, quote, provide one-stop shopping so that every federal anti-terrorist screener is working off the same page, whether it's an airport screener, an embassy official using visas overseas, or an FBI agent on the street, end of quote. It is unclear what criteria the government will use to place individuals on the watch list or if citizens will be able to appeal their inclusion in the FBI-controlled database. Anthony Romero, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, said, quote, our greatest concern is that innocent people might be wrongly labeled as terrorists with little or no recourse to clear their names. The government must tell us how it plans to keep this watch list from turning into a blacklist that will inevitably ruin innocent lives.
Well, we're on the phone right now with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael, a one-stop shopping, 100,000 name terror list?
You know, I don't think it's really a question of just having some innocent names on the list and that being the problem. The problem is the list altogether. Everybody on that list is innocent. I mean, the question is, why is there a list at all other than to basically say people are guilty until proven innocent? That list is going to go all over the place and basically bias and prejudice people's lives, whether it comes to getting a job, particularly a government job or anything else. As Juan pointed out, there's no criteria that we know of how you get on that list. Why there has to be a list at all, I don't know. It's one thing to have suspects that you investigate, a handful, a few, a hundred, a few hundred, but to have a list of 100,000 people that you can't get on and off, that you don't know the criteria that's going to circulate, is really a political, legal, and moral outrage. It reminds me, and Juan may remember this, maybe you as well, Amy, when, you know, Hoover had lists like this.
Yes.
There was the rabble-rouser index in the 60s and 70s. There was a security index. Those were all ways of classifying basically people based on their free speech, on their political activities. And that's what this list is really about. This is going to put all of us into a list of various people who, you know, oppose U.S. policies in the Mideast, you know, oppose whatever else. And I think this is really going to be a dissenters list.
Now, we already saw these lists being developed, right? The CAPS program at airports. How does this list, is this a separate list from that? And is this now being given out to just local businesses?
Well, I think that this is going to be what we call the super list. This is going to take all those lists. CAPS hasn't really been completed at the airports, but there is, of course, a no-fly list of some sort. And those lists will all feed into this master list. At this point, they haven't revealed yet whether employers are going to be able to get this list. Certainly government employers will get this list. But these lists
it
have
does
any
say,
life of their
it,
own.
It does say it will be given to private industry.
Well, then it's really even more awful than I would ever suspect, because what I was going to say is that these lists do go eventually get a life of their own and get circulated. There's a list now of 370 people on some kind of list like this, and that's been all over the place. You can get it on the Internet now of people who are, and there's a lot of people who should never have been on that list. There's a lot of people who are double names or similar names. So once this list gets out to the world, that's it. I mean, what can you imagine? 100,000 people on a list? Someone's going to get a hold of
it. We only have 10 seconds. How do you deal with this? How will CCR do
this? You've got to fight completely. I mean, I think that, you know, you can't allow a list like this at all. It's not a question of innocent or guilty. It's a question of why in the heck should we have a list of people based on suspicion, unarticulated suspicion. So we've got to, I mean, I presume as soon as we find someone on this list, if not before, we've got
to. Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Michael Ratner, president for Center Constitutional Rights. Folks, if you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. You can get the transcript. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burf, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Jeremy Scaho, Pervez Sharma, and Anna Guerra, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Yes.